if you like betting on golf. But everyone that you back misses the cut. Get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more. 'Cause it's the golf betting system. The golf betting system is the golf betting system podcast.
Greetings and welcome to the Golf Betting System podcast 139. This is our 2020 Masters in-depth research preview. Paul Williams and Barry O'Hanrahan join me, Steve Bamford, to discuss the most highly anticipated major of this year and every year, the Masters. Hi, gentlemen. How are we?
Afternoon, guys.
Ah, oh, Paul, come on. We need to do a better start than that.
Sorry.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Afternoon, guys.
It's the Masters. Come on. I know it's the. Yeah, no, I know it's not Masters week, but, you know, come on.
It's thrown me doing a podcast in the afternoon. It's like the graveyard shift, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Everything's upside down this year, you know, like Masters in November and podcasts in the afternoon. I mean, what next? We might actually pick a winner. Like, come on.
Pick a winner.
Well,
yeah.
What you don't understand with Paul is he's awake by 5 a.m. working. He packs up by about 4 p.m. and he's in bed by 7 p.m.
That's on a good day.
Exactly. So this is late in the day and he hasn't had any alcohol yet.
You sure about that?
Yeah, true. This podcast is for listeners of 18 and above. Please be gamble aware. You can visit begambleaware.org for more information. And of course, please bet responsibly. Visit our world famous golf betting system website with our in-depth betting previews. The preview that we're going to go through, or I'm going to talk through today, is available right now at Golf Betting System. We're going to have masses of Masters tournament stats and, of course, our predictor model, all available completely free of charge with no paywall. Please subscribe to this podcast and drive the popularity of the show. We are available on social media. Barry, what's your Twitter handle?
Oh, yeah, that a good talk spoiled. I always mean to tweet more, but I don't. It's weird. I like reading, but I don't. The posting feels like a bit too much of a stretch sometimes.
Paul, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Golf Betting, which is available for purchase if any of you are feeling particularly... no, it's not really. At Golf Betting.
I swear I'm more excited than this.
And mine is at Bamford Golf. I thought I'd just sort of mix things up, gentlemen, just to keep you on your toes. You can join our Golf Betting System Facebook group. The link is available in the description box. And as ever, I'm on the request for Apple podcast reviews. We want some 5-star reviews. Clearly, if you get them written in the very near future, I will be able to read them out for Tuesday's Masters podcast, which is going to be our biggest downloaded show of the year. I've got one here from a friend of the podcast, chaps. It's Hans Gievers via Apple Podcasts. He lives in the United States of America. I believe Hans actually lives in Florida. The title of the review is Best Betting DFS Golf Podcast. He's given us 5 stars. I have been listening to this podcast and Steve's YouTube show every week for over 3 years. Poor bugger. That's all I can say. Without a doubt, Steve, Paul and Barry are the sharpest in the industry when it comes to breaking down the PGA Tour and European tours. It's a great podcast. Hans, thank you very, very, very much for your 5-star review. And as I said, if you could add to Hans's review in the next couple of days, I will read them out at the start of our Masters podcast on Tuesday.
Yes, thanks, Hans. And Hans is one of those people who's very interactive with us on social media as well, and it's always appreciated. And it's great to get feedback and questions and some good interactions. So that's very much appreciated too.
Talking of another podcast follower, we got in. Billy G wrote us a review a couple of weeks ago, and I said on the podcast I'd keep in touch with Billy because he lives in Georgia. So he's been constantly sending me DMs on Twitter, giving me weather updates. So we can go into that in a short while, because clearly we have, and this is a fantastic segue. We're jumping from Billy G straight into our Masters research podcast by saying it's in November and all of the talk is about how the golf course will play and what the weather is likely to be for the 2020 Masters compared to what we see at the start of April each and every year. Weather-wise, I've been digging into this afternoon, and as I said, Billy's been giving me some information quite regularly. He mentioned a few weeks ago that they had a weekend where it absolutely hammered down with rain, and you can actually see that on some of the rainfall statistics for October. But I have to say, over the last, and I've checked a couple of weather, what would you call
website,
it?
Steve, services, websites. Yeah, no, we can use lots of.
No, if you go to, weather stations. I always use Vundergrund for this. You can basically pick what weather station you want in the area. So I've picked a couple in the Augusta, or around Augusta National, and they're both kind of saying the same thing. Rain in October, 56 millimetres or 48 millimetres. And of that, it looks like the last 14 days, there hasn't been a great deal of precipitation. There was a hell of a lot in September, and this was what Billy was telling me. And what, you know, we're talking over 200 millimetres for September. In total across October, 50 millimetres, and since the turn of the month, where there's been no actual precipitation at all. Now, of course, this all comes back to is how long and how soft is the golf course going to play? Now, a lot of that will also come through in temperature. Now, of course, we're seeing forecasts now, 10-day forecasts. We're not seeing right now, we're recording this Thursday afternoon in the UK, we're not seeing forecasts that even stretch through the full 4 days of the tournament. But what we are seeing so far, and Barry, you mentioned this off mic, the temperatures look quite warm so far in the forecast. Thursday up to 26 degrees Celsius. Apologies for you guys in the States or Canada on Fahrenheit.
That's
28 degrees Celsius on Friday.
It's 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, I believe.
It seems quite warm.
Yeah, it's an awful lot warmer than...
Are they playing this on Mercury?
Yeah. It's an awful lot warmer. It's in the 70s in Fahrenheit. It's a lot warmer than we have been, let's say... holding our breath in anticipation to hear what the week to 10-day forecast out is going to be. So that's it's interesting because a lot of the thoughts, let's say, I've had, and I think you guys as well, have been hyper towards the extreme length players and that everybody else can just, you know, you could just throw a line through them. But with, you know, these mid-20s, temperatures, you know, happening at the tournament, ball's going to fly pretty well, and it could also mean that if they had a week of that, it'll help the ground dry out. So it won't be the cold, wet, and windy, you know, mid-December west coast of Ireland conditions that I had, you know, had as the worst case scenario. It's certainly interesting. It could feel very like the April Masters.
Yeah. It doesn't sound that dissimilar, really, does it? You know, if it's high 70s, low 80s, as you've described, it's not going to be that different, apart from the fact, clearly, the flowers that we see at the start of the year in the spring are not going to be about. But other than that, the course could play not dissimilar. Notwithstanding the mornings, I guess there's still going to be a bit more moisture around in the mornings, and it's likely to be a little bit softer. Of course, we've still got the sub-air system at Augusta, which... is going to, you know, allow the organisers to manage the turf conditions as much as they reasonably can. But it could have been an awful lot worse, couldn't it? It could have been really wet, could have been really cold, could be really windy. But it looks like it's going to be quite pleasant, which probably does equalise the field a little bit. Otherwise, it could have just turned into a Bryson fest, which is the way the market is kind of still suggesting it's going to go. But
I thought we might see something. And this, and I mean, I've seen interviews from, you know, players that have played November and December golf round Augusta saying, you know, they played it in, you know, stuff like 12, 14 degrees. Mm. The other thing I've noticed on this early forecast is that there isn't much differential really from the start of the morning right the way through the day. I mean, apparently it's 22 degrees Celsius at 7 a.m. on the Thursday, and it just warms up to 26 throughout the day. Mm. So it's not a scenario where, you know, it's going to be 15, 16 degrees in the morning and the afternoon starters are going to get, a, you know, 10 degrees more with more of that, you know, the longer ball flight.
Yeah. I wish we could get that weather in November, lads.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, I wish we could get on the golf course, but that's a completely different conversation.
Let's not go down that path.
Yeah, we won't go down that path. Wind as well. It's a forecast. It's over. It's a week away. They'll clearly will be playing this time next week. But if you take this on, you know, at full value, it looks like Thursday light breezes. Friday, the strongest wind you're going to get is about 15 miles an hour. Now around Augusta, 15 miles an hour, with the way that they play with the undulations, the valleys, the trees, wind coming from all directions, that level of wind gets to the point where that starts to become an issue, especially if you've got no experience of the course. Mm. So, you know, Friday looks like there might be some wind in play. And Saturday, it's early doors and we're seeing only just a part of the day so far being forecast. That's looking like it could be 20 miles an hour gusts. So that starts to become even more of a factor. But anyway, we can discuss that more on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Now, I've got some points and some sort of facts and stuff we can run through. What I wanted to do for the listeners is talk to you two about, from a betting perspective, what do you think punters and, you know, and DraftKings players who are listening need to be looking out for in terms of the golf course, how it plays? Do you think that course experience is vital? Do you necessarily think that short hitters can't win around here? And just throw it out to you two. So, Barry, over to you. You can start. What do you think are the key facets to be a winner at Augusta?
I think at this stage it's about pulling together a lot of the things we've had over the last few years in our conversations about it. So things like apex height. So, you know, you want your irons coming in from, you know, on a quite vertical drop to minimize how much that ball is going to be, you know, shooting forward on the green. Or let's say maximizes your predictability on where the ball will finish on the green. So if anybody has been kind of keeping an eye on gear setups for players over the last few days, you'll have seen Mickelson talking about going into not quite a game improver set of irons, but a more forgiving set of irons that'll help him launch the ball higher and with less spin. And his idea is to get the ball coming down more vertically. So, you know, I think if you're taking that point as something that one of the game's most experienced guys is talking about, and, you know, he won't be the only one doing it, go to the flip of that and look at guys who have a very low ball flight. They're going to have a harder time dealing with Augusta because their ball's going to be shooting forward a bit more when it lands in the greens and is susceptible to the big swales and, let's say, bumps on these greens. Bumps is a terrible word for those greens, but...
Contours.
Thank you very much. The thesaurus. So let's say somebody like a Brandon Grace or an Abraham Anser, both very low ball flight hitters, and they're going to have to play that little bit better for what they do to be contending with somebody who has a very high iron apex. So that's one key thing. I mean, I don't think you need to be particularly looking for somebody who's got like a 75% driving accuracy, because there's quite a bit of relative width in these fairways, and they effectively play a little bit wider because of the direction that the grass is mown. So the grain is towards the tee box, so the ball won't release as much when it actually hits the ground, which makes the effective width of the fairways wider than they actually physically are. So driving accuracy is not uber important. You just don't want to be incredibly wild and hitting punch outs from the trees.
Yeah, there's certainly a scope to recover, isn't there? If you hit a wide one, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be chopping out sideways. You may be able to manufacture some kind of recovery shot. It's interesting what you say about the way that the grass is mown, because it effectively makes it the fairways play as if they're softer than they actually are. Mm-hmm.
Minimises roll.
It does, yeah. Equally, that then makes them play longer. So, you know, what's already a long track, which I suspect it will, from tee to green, I suspect it will be a little bit softer than it would ordinarily be in April. So it's, you know, those two elements do make it play long anyway. I'm with you, Barry. I wouldn't be loading up on accuracy as being the most important factor, I don't think.
No, and I think if you're really kind of burying into the nitty-gritty of how far guys drive the ball, I think looking at a stat such as carry distance versus driving distance might actually be a more relevant one here, in that you can see if the guy you fancy does in fact hit the ball a reasonable distance it through the air. Because somebody like, let's say, an Abraham Answer could have a 310 driving distance, but his carry distance could be 10 or 15 yards shorter than somebody else who has a 310-yard driving distance, but their ball is descending from on a much more steep angle and won't roll as far as Answer's. So just I think at this stage with Augusta, we're so familiar with it, it's about trying to find those little nuances to help narrow down your selections and become more confident in your selections.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, for me, greens and regulation is probably the key stat of the whole lot. I think hitting greens to give yourself an opportunity to make birdie around Augusta National is absolutely critical. I mean, it's an easy thing to say, because if you're hitting greens where whichever course you play, clearly you're going to give yourself more chance of playing well, of compiling a decent score. But that's accentuated even more at Augusta National for me. And if you combine in, I agree with you, Barry, Apex, distance to Apex is one that we tend to have picked out for this. And that's often a function of players who hit the ball high and hard. And as you say, you're getting control over your approach shots then, so they're landing on these perilous greens and you know, in a position where you can actually then... get a putt towards the pin rather than struggling from 50, 60 feet on these tricky dance floors. If you go through, and there'll be a load of trends pieces out there. And if you want some background on the kind of trends, check out the work that Dave Tindall's done on his Twitter feed, because he produces something similar each year, which goes through the trends of Augusta National winners over the last few years and highlights the player that could or should theoretically fit based on how and what the winners have done here over the past. It doesn't tend to be quite as cut and dried and as formulaic as that. I think you need to apply a level of knowledge and a level of logic to those kind of things. But you know, certainly, Steve, you mentioned course history and players that have done well or at least played the track in the past. And, you know, we'd all quote the Fuzzy Zeller being the last debutant to win at Augusta National. But even excluding that as a fact, you will find that recent winners have got some kind of finish, some kind of cut made at least at Augusta National in recent years to suggest that they have played the course, they have got some reasonably positive experience at the track. I think the worst recent winner in terms of course history was Patrick Reed. I've not got it written down exactly what his previous finish is, but I suspect it was something like 40 or 44, something like that.
I've got that here, Paul. Bear with me. They were his best finish at Augusta.
Bear with me.
Was, Bear with me. I have it. I'm bearing slowly. It was 40th. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. So, and there was him. I think Schwarzenegger had finished 30th or something like that as well.
So it was 20 seconds.
It was 22nd.
Can you not read Wikipedia, Steve, now?
Tiger Woods had won four times though. I know that much.
You don't have to have finished second or third or, you know, been extremely close, but I think some positive looks at the track and understanding what the technicalities of it will be are positive. The other factor which will be interesting this year is how current form affects players and how much of a determinant that is, because, you know, ordinarily we'd be playing this in April. Players would be honing their game or sharpening their game over the first two or three months of the year to get themselves in a position to be peaking for the first week of April. And clearly that's all completely on its head. Everyone's had to go through this kind of rearranged and rushed back end of the season. And, you know, the new season kicked in immediately after the previous one had finished, and some players have been playing, some haven't. And, you know, again, trends where you might look and say, well, everyone, or pretty much everyone, I think Adam Scott's the exception, had some really positive, well, at least the top 20 finish in the last sort of 8 weeks or so, heading into an April Augusta that they subsequently won. And that holds for, you know, the last 6, 8, 10 years, whatever the number is. How that changes this year with the fact that players' schedules have been turned on their heads, how they've had to adapt to the COVID situation. Some of the guys have had COVID and have had to sit out for a number of weeks. It throws some of those trends into question, and how that manifests this week will be something to look at, I think.
We're also going to have a slightly different golf course this week because of the time of year. They're going to actually overseed it, or it has been overseeded, with perennial ryegrass.
Right.
And I'm going to push listeners towards the No Laying Up podcast that was recorded, I think it was released yesterday, actually, with Matty Kelly, Mark Leishman's caddy. Fascinating insight from Matty Kelly. Well worth a listen.
Yeah.
But he mentioned in that the fact that when you play Augusta, you do get this mix of ryegrass and Bermuda grass on the golf course. It's a perennial, it's actually the whole course is Bermuda grass based. Clearly the greens are A1 Penn bent grass. But at this time of year, they're having to put a lot more overseed of the ryegrass, both on the fairways and in the rough. Mm. So there's going to be slightly different fairway and rough conditions that they're used to in April.
You're never getting an invite to Augusta, Steve. You know that. You keep calling it rough. It's the first cut. Come on.
First cut. Yeah. To be fair, they don't have rough at Augusta.
No.
Isn't it like 1.25 inches is the rough?
Yeah. It's not really. Listened to that podcast last night, and after the course very well after all the years we've watched it, but after a couple of holes, I went, this is not good. I need to visualize what I'm hearing. So fired up the Masters app and started, you know, looking through the holes as Matty Kelly was talking through the holes with Solly and Tron, and it was just fascinating. I was completely engrossed, and, you know, always think that you're looking at things critically or a golf course critically, but the factors that they were considering just way beyond what I'd ordinarily think is required for taking on a golf course. Brilliant listen, and I mean, kind of puts anything we would do to shame in terms of talking about the course itself other than in generalities. So highly recommend going to listen to that.
Feeding back to what you said though about height of apex and just a high approach shot ball flight.
Mm-hmm.
Matty mentioned as well, because they said, oh, well, you know, you do hear that the draw shape off the tee is an advantage. What do you think? And he said, well, theoretically it's an advantage, he said, but at the end of the day, if you can hit the ball high, you can hit whatever shot shape you like. He backed you up, you know, a high ball flight is absolutely essential for Augusta. Distance to apex, really, really important. You can see that statistically in my preview as well. Most, you know, the winners around here all have top third on tour distance to apexes. You know, it happens year in, year out.
Yeah, and that's probably, I mean, this is one that you kind of came up with, was it a couple of years ago, Steve? You really kind of honed in on this distance to apex. And I mean, that could be your first starting point about chopping the fields down. If it's anybody in, let's say, the bottom half of distance to apex on the PGA Tour stats section of the website, you could probably put a line through them. And if they somehow win, then it's a complete Zach Johnson and 2007 anomaly, and everybody will still be scratching their heads in 13 years' time as to why somebody that short won when there's so many prodigiously long players out there.
Nobody outside of the top 70 in terms of distance to apex have won the Masters since 2009. The lowest ball flight is Jordan Spieth. But even Tiger Woods last year, he was in the top 40 for distance to apex. I mean, and it's not necessarily brute power. It's you know, at what point your ball flight tops out from where you've actually hit the ball off the tee. And also approach shot. So, yeah. High and handsome is what you need around Augusta. That is undoubted. I've got various different information here. One of the things I find very, very interesting, it's a bit of a quick fact. Nobody outside the top 29 in the world has won the Masters since Angel Cabrera in 2009. And as we know, Cabrera was very much an Augusta national specialist. He ranked 69th in the world when he won it in 2009, Cabrera. Since then, nobody outside the top 29 in the world have won.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you go and be as brutal as cutting the field down to the top 30, then you're going to get yourself, you know, particularly when you start applying some of these other factors, as you said, you know, top third or top 70 in distance to apex, take all the debutants out. You're starting to get to a point where, you know, players who've got some kind of reasonable finish there in the past, you can quickly get down to a shortlist. And the beauty of Augusta, the beauty of the Masters over the last few years, is generally these trends, these stats, these facts have held water for the subsequent year. The year that you're looking at, and it really does help you to get to a point where you can make a more comfortable and confident prediction of the players that are actually going to go well in the forthcoming week.
That could change with the time of year.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but
yeah, nothing's a given.
You know, in November, is that really going to advantage shorter, lower ball flight hitters? You know, logically, it just can't, can it?
No,
you know,
no,
if it
no, no.
is going to be cooler, if it is going to be softer turf conditions, it doesn't feel that way whatsoever.
No. It's kind of an anti Open Championship in the respect that with an Open where it's, you know, potentially coastal, linksy, you know, potentially windy, that a low ball flight would be absolutely perfect. And you're looking at the direct opposite for Augusta National, where you're saying, well, you know, someone who hits it hard and hits it high is going to be the most likely fit for getting around and compiling the kind of competitive score that's going to be up there on Sunday afternoon.
You won't be surprised to hear that Jordan Spieth, who's co-leader in Houston, his price is being slashed as we speak.
Yeah, what was he, odds on now, is he?
He's favourite. He's up there with DeChambeau. No, he's not. He's a 33-1 shot. That takes me as well. The Masters in recent times has really thrown up some value winners. Mm. And it's so, so easy to look at the top of a betting board and go, well, you know, Bryson DeChambeau at 8-1. Who's going to get close to him? Or it has to be John Rahm. You listen to the prices of winners recently. I mean, even last year, Tiger Woods was a 16-1 shot. Patrick Reed, 55-1. Sergio Garcia, 45-1. Danny Willett, 66-1.
And bear in mind, all of these players were in the top 29 in the world rankings when the tournament was played, and they're all outside of 29 in their odds that they went off at, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Jordan Spieth in 2015, fair enough, Jordan Spieth was 12-1. But then we go Bubba Watson at 28, Adam Scott at 28, Bubba Watson the first time at 55s, and Charles Schwartzel, you won't be surprised, he's the outsider of the lot, 2011, 90-1.
I hate him so much for that. I had the other four guys in the top five with four holes to go. He birdies for finishing four holes.
There's a magical finish. Not so magical if you're in the position you're
in. No, it was pretty special. And another unique way to torture a golf gambler.
Now, I haven't got the sheet in front of me, but Tiger Woods at 16-1. Where would you think he would have been in the betting itself? What, fifth, sixth, seventh favourite?
No, but maybe fifth. Yeah, fourth or fifth. You'd have got a couple of guys that are in.
You'd have had Rahm shorter, McIlroy shorter, DJ shorter, JT maybe shorter.
Yeah, in that kind of bracket.
Kepka.
By the time you've got the
close enough.
By the time you've got a full market on Monday, because we're talking Thursday afternoon here, and we're only just starting to see the bookies formulate their plans. So there's only two or three have already extended their each way places out to something sensible beyond the five that bog standard for the anti post market, and then we'll see which hands they play. As we get towards, maybe over the weekend, but certainly by Monday.
Yeah.
And some will go 10, 11 places and with particularly poor prices, and some will go five or six with fantastic prices, and some will go for a nice blend in the middle, maybe seven or eight with some attractive prices as well. But certainly the prices we're seeing at the moment are particularly unattractive as far as I'm concerned.
Another myth I want to blow up on the podcast is they say that, you have to have experience around here to win. Well, Charles Schwartzel in 2011, Jordan Spieth in 2015, and Danny Willett in 2016 had only ever played Augusta in competition once before they won.
I think you need to have had a look at it to get a feel.
Yeah.
You don't need to have played 25 times to be able to win. It's that much is for sure.
Personally, I would never back a Augusta rookie here. But undoubtedly, if you've had a run around here and you've made the cut, and even if it's like a 20th or 40th place finish, you're still in the ball game if your shape of game fits.
But for the outright winner, I get that, I understand that. In terms of trying to find a fit for someone who's capable of getting themselves into an each way finishing position at a long price. I want, it'd be easy to get blinded by the history and the fact that players need to have played Augusta National in the past. And, some years it proves that, the top eight, top 10, they've all played before. Some years you'll get a debutant who comes in and, not necessarily seriously contends, but finishes at a fourth or a fifth or a sixth and produces a decent each way return for you. You can have plucked him out before.
Especially if you can grab somebody at 100-1 with like 9-10 places.
In a short field as well.
It's fantastic. Your pit's paying 20-1 for the place. Obviously, you lose your win stake, but other than that, you can have plenty of interest from guys. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but Morikawa he's debutant, I think, this year, this time. He's going to be extremely short, but he's somebody you would think has a very good shade of being in the top 10, even though it's his first time round.
Yeah. Mm. Well, don't forget 2014, Jordan Spieth almost won it as a rookie, didn't he? Mm.
Yeah.
But that was the year Bubba won it. But another great example of what you guys are saying. In terms of a good each-way price, I was talking in terms of winner, as you said, but in terms of actual each-way money, Thomas Peters in 2017, 80-1, he finished in fourth spot on Augusta National debut. Mm. So it can and does happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the flip side of this is that you get players
Cameron Smith did it as well.
Mm.
He's an interesting player, Cameron Smith. I think he's one that I'm going to have a serious look at in terms of if I can get to that kind of 100-to-1 price point. Sorry, he came fifth in 2018. He had one appearance before that. But yes, it is possible to actually get, you know, especially with 10 places available each way. Of course, rookies can get into the each-way spots. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned Angel Cabrera. I mean, I'm not talking about Cabrera in this same vein right now, but there are clearly players who can lift their game each and every year when they arrive here who are often at a far longer price than perhaps they should be. I mean, the one that caught my eye just from the initial analysis that I did was Matt Kuchar, currently trading at 320 to win this. 125 to one each way if you want to go to one of the regular bookies right now. And I suspect that that will get pushed out a little bit more. Kuchar's not been playing some very particularly good golf recently. That much is evident from his recent finishes. But if you look, he's got, I'm just counting up, 1, 2, 3, 4 top eight finishes in his last 8 Augusta appearances. That's 50%. So 50% of the time that he's teed it up at Augusta National in the last 8 years, he has finished inside the top eight.
Yeah, but no,
and he's available.
So say knowing Kuchar, you'd probably he'd finish like tied 10th and with 6 other players, and you'd only get like a sixth of your expected fee for the week from him. Like,
yeah, you'd have had a run for your money, and assuming that he bogeyed the last, you'd have had something to rant and rave about on the podcast the following week.
There's another guy at 100-to-1 that I think's game's going to suit around here perfectly, and he won on the PGA Tour for the first time a few weeks ago. Jason Kokrang. Very long, very high, brilliant player on bent grass and also on classical golf courses. They're the kind of players you want to be looking at. Did you say you had some trends you wanted to bring up, Paul?
Well, only that I go, you know, through the things that you've listed in your pointer preview, which, as you say, you link to from this podcast,
yeah,
and the factors that you can tangibly pick out. So distance to apex, where you've mentioned the players inside the top. I think it was 67 was the number, but if you said like
top 70 on the tour, so you can just basically take that from the PGA Tour stats website.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, we're in this odd situation, aren't we, where we're at the start of a new season in terms of stats. So
take last year as well. Yeah,
last 4 years probably a better view of it. Yeah, par 4 birdie or better is another stat that you've picked out, which has been really quite strong over the last few years. World ranking top 30, you know, again, it's rock solid, isn't it, over the last 10 years. You can't argue with that. Now, if someone who's 35th or 50th or whatever goes and wins the Masters next week, then it blows that out of the water. If it doesn't, then it's another tick in that box for a particularly strong trend. Best finish, players who finished in the top 30, top 40 previously, something like that. You know, I guess if you're picking that out as having a positive look, a cut made at the very least at Augusta National in the past. Recent form, again, where you can probably cut it a little bit different this week. But if you said, well, you know, you want a player who's at least finished inside the top 20 in one of his previous starts in the last couple of months or so, then you'll pick, you know, you're going to pluck out the players that at least flashed a little bit of form. And then you've got, you know, the basic stuff like greens and regulation. For me, again, that's one of the absolute key critical stats here, bogey avoidance. Performances on bent grass greens. Again, when we put the predictor together for next week, we'll have bent grass green performance over the last 5 years, classical course performance over the last 5 years as well.
Do you factor in scrambling at all, Paul?
I'm so reliant on greens and regulation in this that I find that's the more dominant aspect to it. And clearly, if you're not hitting greens, you're going to have to be scrambling well. But I think it's more important to be hitting the greens in the first place than to be surviving and recovering when you're missing them.
Yeah,
is my view.
The reason I bring it up is that what Matty Kelly said on the podcast, he said, look, you can, it's the kind of place that, if you're not on your A-plus game and you're kind of knocking it about a bit, he said, if you do have a good short game, you can cover yourself, cover your ass for a day or two at least. Anyway,
get you towards the top of the leaderboard. Just come the weekend,
just hang around, make post that 70 or maybe sneak a 69, 70, 71 or something like that. You just hang around on a day that you could have had a 75 or 76 and be out of it. It's just that kind of got me to raise the question. And I mean, it's, I remember, if you think back to when Molinari was, before Molinari, I mean, I think we also almost need to have like a before Masters and after Masters with Molinari. Like,
I was going to say, Molly who? Yeah, I don't know who this golfer is.
Before the moment, his entire life changed, and then after, and ever since then, which was the 12th at Augusta. But that Sunday, I mean, he was getting up and down from like garbage cans, and porta potties way off the side of the green. It was absolutely phenomenal to watch. And you're just thinking, my God, he couldn't go through the whole round doing this. And as it happened, he couldn't. The 12th got to him.
You're putting yourself under too much pressure and too much stress to continue to make the score that you need to make. At the back end of Augusta National, as you get into the kind of the final third of the course, you've got some scoring opportunities. And if you're constantly chasing because you're missing greens, you're scrambling all the way through the
round.
That's
where you need to be making hay, not scrambling for par.
You can't be doing it. You almost need to get your game into a tip-top position by the time that you hit those scoring holes and then make hay.
That's true.
Produce a 4 or 5 under finish over the last 6 or 8 holes.
And how many players have you seen, like 1 under, 2 under, going through Amen Corner, and all of a sudden you look at the end of the round, they're at 6 or 7 under?
Yeah. Absolutely.
They've absolutely, they've taken the last third of the round and they've scored really heavily.
Yeah, I remember the year that the world and his wife, me included, was on Angel Cabrera. And he was, again, after a couple of rounds, he was nowhere really. And then I'm sure he birdied something like the last 5 holes on the trot on Saturday to get himself right into contention. And then, the rest was history. He didn't quite make it, but, got himself into that position where he quite reasonably could have won that golf tournament.
It was last year, wasn't it, when Cantlay hit the front? Was it last year? I think it was. It feels so long ago. Sorry, it's 1.5 or 1.8 years ago. But he hit the front and all the rest of the guys were still, the chasing pack at that time were on the front nine. And you knew he needed to go and post and keep getting the, birdies and eagles. Obviously he didn't. But there's also the fact that you have to not panic at that stage and start backing everybody or laying everybody because they have those scoring holes to come on the Sunday.
Yeah, and that's for me. That's part of the charm of the tournament and the track is that you've got this finish where you know there are great opportunities there. Even on the Sunday, all the way up to the 17th, the 16th rather the par 3.
Yeah,
it's a birdie or it's even a very outside holding one opportunity with the position they put the pin in, and nothing's a given until your player's got to that hole and. They could make a 1 or they could make a 5. It's it's that kind of track, and that's a massive part of the excitement for me is that the way the track actually sets up.
Yeah, I mean 13.
Going back to your point,
No, I was just going to say 13 through 16 are just so crucial. Absolutely. whatever about like Amen Corner, your 10, 11, 12. If you can get through them at what level par. It's about avoiding disaster there, right? Let's all be honest about that. But 13 through 16, if you're not going through that stretch in 2 under par minimum every day, you're probably losing shots in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I can't quote it because I haven't got the number in front of me, but I've quoted in the past the variance of players scoring. And those who've contended, and those who've been also rans, the 13th and the 15th holes are absolutely critical. The variance between a player's performance is so heavily pivoted on their score on those 2 holes over the course of the 4 days. You could sit down and think, well, that's going to push me towards par 5 scoring as being the absolutely most critical element to this, but it's not because there are a plethora, as you've pulled out in the preview piece, Steve, of different angles and trends and stats that kind of all go into the melting pot together to produce the final answer, or hopefully produce the final answer.
The last, since 2014, the par four birdie or better is a really interesting stat. I know you mentioned it a little few minutes ago. So Bubba Watson ranked, arriving at Augusta National that season, fifth for par four birdie or better. And I'll just run through. Spieth was first. Willett was second, even though you had to kind of look at his stats because he wasn't a full PGA to remember. But anyway, Garcia was seventh. Patrick Reed was seventh. And then last year with Tiger Woods, not the season he won, because don't forget they have split seasons, but the previous season when he won at Eastlake that season, he'd ranked in the top 11 for par four birdie or better. So, yeah, right now, par four birdie or better ranks, yeah? I'll take 11 as the cutoff. So, for last season, so we're talking up until the Tour Championship, Fleetwood at 9, DeChambeau at 8, Reed at 7, Justin Thomas 6, Hatton at 4, Scotty Scheffler at 3, Dustin Johnson 2, Webb Simpson number 1. And if you're looking at this embryonic season, 10, Tyrrell Hatton, 11, Brooks, JT, DeChambeau, Xander, and Ryan Palmer. Who knows, eh? The other thing is, we were talking about greens and regulation, and I keep trackers, yeah?
Yeah.
And I've just gone back to previous years on my greens and regulation tracker. And basically, I track, you know, within the field, how players have been doing with their greens in regulation for 8 weeks. And I used to do it for 10 weeks prior to the tournament. If I go back to Danny Willett in 2016, he ranked sixth in the field for greens in regulation, turning up at the event. Sergio Garcia ranked second the next year. There is an abnormality with Patrick Reed, although Reed, I think, had finished like, I don't know, something like greens regulation of seventh or something, two outings before, so he was finding some greens. And then last year, Tiger Woods, in the same tracker, ranked second. So Willett sixth, Garcia second, Woods second. So I've just pulled off my tracker this afternoon, just to see where we're standing right now. This doesn't include, of course, the Houston Open, which is ongoing, so these numbers will change. But right now, if I go through my greens and regulation tracker for the last 8 weeks, Bubba Watson ranks number one. Tony Finau ranks number two. John Rahm, number three. Sung Jae-im, number four. And then we've got Eric Van Ruin and Zach Johnson ranking tied for fifth. I'm also seeing Dustin Johnson in the top 10 with Lee Westwood and Matty Wallace, believe it or not. There you go.
Yes, plenty to
chew on. Maybe Zach Johnson's going to win again.
I mean, Matt Wallace could be that kind of guy who gets himself a top 10 and gets you that each way place. At the moment, he's 150 to 1 in most places. So if you can get one of those combined with the top 10, you know.
Undoubtedly, Matty Wallace, I mean, Paul follows him week in, week out, and he's always a ridiculously short price on the European Tour for obvious reasons. But you just look at his GIR numbers, 8th, 23rd, 4th at that event they played up at St Andrews a few weeks ago, 25th last time out in Italy. He is hitting a decent number of greens at the moment.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's been playing some good stuff. He scuppered himself last year, didn't he? Because he won the par three competition, and then
he won't make that mistake again this year.
No, but no, they can't. Sadly, they've cancelled the par three. So, yeah, I always like that as a little warm up to pass the time on the day before. But sadly, not happening this year.
Some of those players that I mentioned, like EVR, like Im, like Zach Johnson, who are playing, Lucas Glover, who are playing in this week's Houston Open. So some of those are likely to fall out of that top 10. The likes of Bryson, Xander and Colin Morikawa are just on the very fringes of that top 10 right now.
Was it you that had
so
that?
Be interesting.
Pardon? Sorry, go finish off there.
It'll just be interesting to see what that kind of GIR tracker looks like on Monday morning when I update it.
Sorry to half cut across there. It was just in relate. You were mentioning that there's a, you know, obviously there's a bunch of guys playing this week, and there's a lot that aren't taking it off. Was it you that highlighted that correlation between not playing the week before and the week before the Masters and success in the Masters, or was it somewhere else I read it?
I don't see too many people that do play Houston and win. That is factual. I mean, clearly Woods hadn't. He played the World Match Play. We're talking about back in April. Reed had played his last outing at the World Match Play. Garcia had done exactly the same, as had Danny Willett. The last one that had played the week before was Jordan Spieth, and he finished second at the Houston Open and then won the Masters at 12-1.
It's an interesting tournament like that, that it feels that guys want to take the week off before it. I don't know if it's a mental preparation thing, because in general it's the first major of the year and they don't want to be spending any mental energy beforehand. But it seems for the other majors, there's less of an intent to avoid the week before. And the guys almost want to be tuning themselves up by playing the week before at that stage. And it may perhaps that's because it's that stage of the season in April, it's early doors and they haven't quite hit their, let's say, top motoring gear for golf at that stage. Or
Mickelson and his pomp always played the week before and often won before, didn't he? I mean when he won the last time here in 2010, he'd finished 35th in Houston. Charles Schwartzel had played in Houston. He'd finished 30th in 2011. But backing up what you were saying, Watson, Scott, Watson, Willett, Garcia, Reed and Woods had not played the week before in the warm-up tournament.
Mm. I mean, it wouldn't completely put me off anybody if they are playing this week. What you do want to see is that signs of decent life in their game, so that if you see them posting a 30th or 40th, that's fine for me, you know, if I'm considering a player. I'm not gonna write somebody off because they're playing this week.
No. It's you don't necessarily have to be coming in with absolutely flying form, but that's just a little sign of life there.
You go on, Paul.
No, I was going to say, just going back to this, those factors that we talked through a second ago. If I've loaded absolutely every one of the factors that we've discussed so far into the field, it does come back to me with three names. Now, the top two are pretty straightforward. It's Bryson DeChambeau and Dustin Johnson, who are around about 8-1 and 12-1 respectively. And I don't think it would take a great deal of time for anyone who vaguely knows golf to make a justification for either of those two players. You know, Dustin's the world number one at the moment, and Bryson's the favourite to win the golf tournament. And based on what we've seen recently, you can understand why people think that his game does fit Augusta National for this season. The third player is a little bit more, I wouldn't say left field, because you can probably get to him quite quickly. A little bit longer, and also fits into this price point that we talked earlier, between that kind of 28-1 up to 55-1 bracket. Anyone want to hazard a guess? I'll give you one guess each as to who that other.
You go first, Steve. I want one less player to have to choose from. So he's between 20.
What was your cut off in terms of, it was top 30 in the world?
Top 30 in the world. Par 4 birdie, a better performance, and top 30 for the season just finished. Top 70 Apex, and then basic stuff like a top 20 recently, a decent enough finish here in the past. High greens in regulation.
I think I.
A bit of classical bent. I have my guess. Avoidance. Go on then. One of you throw
me, please. Tyrrell Hatton.
I'd have said Hatton or T4 Tony.
Tony Finau is the player who ticks every single box from all of the stat pieces all of the stats that feature in your preview piece, and also the kind of subjective stuff that I've added myself.
Isn't that
Bryson, Dustin Johnson, Tony Finau.
Isn't
and I read him out second in this GIR track. Yeah.
Mm. Isn't that the problem with Tony, though? He always ticks all these boxes and he still doesn't bloody win. That's
so what price? 10th and 5th from his two attempts at Augusta National. 35-1 in the kind of anti-post market here. What price is acceptable?
We've had this conversation many times, haven't we, gentlemen?
It's like,
do you back Tony Finau in the 3M Open when he's 16-1, or do you back him in a major because he's got some fantastic major performances when he's at 33 or 35?
At this stage, I mean, I think I said it a few weeks ago. I'm pretty much probably going to auto bet Tony Finau because I feel like he's virtually a lock to get a place if I'm getting 10 places. Yep. So if I can get 33-1, 10 places on Tony Finau, I'm putting a chunk on it.
Yep. Mm. Statistically, that would suggest to be the right thing to do, Barry. Last four outings, 5th, 17th, 8th, 11th. So two of those last four, he's been inside the top eight.
Yeah. 10th and 5th. It feels like it's close to a free punt, you know. It's not free, but it feels as confident as you can be in somebody getting a place. Like, I feel more confident saying Tony Finau will top 10 than Rory McIlroy will top 10. I mean, how messed up is that? Yeah. But I think that's because Rory has more variance in his game.
There is more variance. That's exactly the right word. There's more variance there where he could win the golf tournament, which I suspect he's got a better chance of winning the Masters than Tony Finau. But if you pick the average finishing position or likely finishing position, Tony's probably going to be getting an average better position out of this golf tournament, I think.
He didn't play too badly last year at Augusta, did he? No.
On a broken ankle after dislocating his ankle.
Yeah, it was the year before.
Oh, was it the year before? Sorry,
But this
is the point, yeah. Two, you're talking 2018, Barry. He finished 10th, and then last year, he's second out, and he's finished 5th.
Tied 5th, yeah.
Would suggest that his game's quite well suited to Augusta National, though.
Yeah, if you can smash the ball miles and hit it way up in the air, yeah. And the fact that Augusta seems to take away a little bit of the putting advantage that the supreme putters have over the regular Joe Soap with the putter. I wonder if that's just because, you know, he's also got
a very sharp short game.
Yeah,
for, you know,
he always has, hasn't he? So it's just it's the putting, and his putting does look a little bit better. He's still got those wobbles, you know, but I guess it's going to happen through 72 holes. I honestly, if I can get 33-1, 10 places, I'm in.
It's a tempter. Seriously.
The other thing with Tony is there aren't many driving areas at Augusta where there's water in play. I hate Tony because he does like finding the water off the tee. But
he
kind of plays to his strengths, doesn't it? Interesting, Paul.
Interesting one to ponder over the weekend.
The one thing against Hatton, and lots of people are talking about him quite right, is I don't know if he did he fall out of your analysis on the ball flight height. Or was it something to do with the fact that he hadn't had a decent finish there?
Hold on.
Because Hatton's another decent player that just jumps out at you at a reasonable price, doesn't it?
Yeah, Apex is just outside. His best finish, the three attempts that he's had at Augusta, missed cut 44th, 56th last year. So
Patrick Reed didn't have a great one either. You know, great set of results at Augusta before he won. I think the Hatton for me has kind of just surprised me, probably more than a lot of other golfers this year. And I'm just not expecting him to perform at the level he keeps performing at. And it's like he's performing above EV, if that makes any sense. It's my own personal EV level that I've put on him. But he just keeps jumping ahead of it and jumping ahead of it and jumping ahead of it. So I took him the other week at, I think I got him at 33-1. I just said, I don't think his price is going to go out from here based on the way he's playing. No. So I kind of fancy him to have a decent shot at the Masters. So I took a little bit of 33-1.
Yeah, now I can see why. For full disclosure, the only bet I've had so far is Bubba Watson. And I bet Bubba before the Masters was cancelled the first time, or postponed, and I have topped up on him more recently when he's shown some form over the last couple of outings, seventh and fourth, isn't he, over the last couple of outings. And you've backed that up nicely, Steve, with your greens and regulations stats. Cause he
well, we jumped on him two outings ago, didn't we? 66-1 we got on him at that CJ Cup, which I thought was an outlandish price. And then everyone caught up that he was actually playing some decent stuff. And he went off, was it like longest price was 33s at the Zozo? Mm-hmm. And he finished fourth there as well. Yeah. I mean, tee to green, last three outings, Bubba Watson. US Open, of all places, sixth for tee to green.
We all predicted missed cut.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what brought me on to Bubba. We said, didn't we, Bubba finished 31st in the US Open. What is going on? Mm-hmm. He then, first for tee to green at the CJ Cup, when we were on him, he finished seventh. And then last time out at the Zozo, fifth for tee to green. And he's just absolutely murdering the ball off the tee and hitting it straight and hitting tons and tons of greens in regulation, which is exactly what you've got to do at Augusta. And he knows those greens in absolute intimate detail.
Indeed.
So, yeah.
I think his...
The one I've backed pre-event is Patrick Reed. I managed to get him at 35-1 about 2 months ago.
That'll work. Yeah. The thing that maybe there's just a thought about Bubba and why he matches up quite well at Augusta. His putting style is to dive the ball into the hole, and so
well like Sergio's.
Kind of. And so when you're diving the ball into the hole around Augusta, you're not going to have as many of these 5, 6, 7 footers that some of the aggressive putters can leave themselves with if they miss their initial putt. And so yes, he has to play a bit more break, but he's not giving him, maybe he's reducing his chances of three putting with his put, you know, by having that dying the ball in the whole putting style.
To go along with that, you've got to look at Lee Westwood's record around here. Westwood's record around Augusta is fabulous. And his putting style is exactly what you're describing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He's not making too many crazy mistakes and running it 6, 7 foot past.
Yeah. Whisper it, but he's actually been putting really quite well on the European Tour when I've been watching him.
I think Westwood might have a run in him as well. There's a few at triple digits I like the look of.
He'd be nice. You'd feel happy enough with the Westwood 80, maybe 90-1 with 10 places. You'd be pretty...
Well, he's 100-1 right now.
Yeah, but that's... You're only getting...
In one spot.
Yeah, I can't see those sliding out to 10 places, though. I mean, but if you could get 90-1 with 10 places, you'd be feeling pretty smug.
And he sits in tied 10th on that GIR tracker at the moment. Yeah, new conditions. I mean, he could play around there blindfolded, couldn't he, Lee Westwood?
And
we've kept saying this for week after week, month after month. Westwood wants to get an automatic spot in that Ryder Cup team, and he needs to stay in the top 50 in the world to start next season, so he knows that all the WGCs, all the majors are covered. And is he literally 50th at the moment, or 49th? He's hanging on with his fingernails, isn't he?
He's there or thereabouts.
So he's going to be fully, fully motivated, I tell you.
Like a top 10 here would go a long, be a nice help.
A long way. Well, yeah, that basically, that gets him in that top 50 spot for Christmas, doesn't it?
I mean, who would you rather be on right now? Say 80-1 or 66-1, Westwood versus Mickelson. Mickelson's shorter.
Oh, that's not even a thought process. You'd take Westwood,
wouldn't you? Yeah. That's an insulting price on Mickelson, isn't it?
I mean, who would you take 100-1? Would you take Gary Woodland, who's injured and has got an awful record here, or Lee Westwood?
Yeah, it's mad.
Yeah.
Or Joakim Niemann at 80-1. There's
another super low ball flight player. I think he's just going to have to play that. He's got less room for errors than somebody who hits the ball high in Augusta, so... It wouldn't be for me.
Exactly. Any more points to raise, or should we leave it at that?
No, I think there's plenty to chew on there, isn't there? And further to your preview that's on the site at the moment, there are also the regular stats that we ordinarily produce on a Monday. They're all available right now. So you've got the history stats for players who are in the field this week for Augusta National going back to 2002. Current form stats, of course, excluding what's happening over in Houston at the moment, and first round leader stats. So it's all there on the site, golfbettingsystem.co.uk right now. So
all available from the homepage. I'm staring at it right now.
Yeah, so if you want to do some early research over the weekend, then fill your boots.
And they are all free, which is absolutely ridiculous, because I don't know if the listeners actually understand how much work Paul and Steve put in.
That's why Paul gets up at 5 a.m.
I know, exactly, to do all the... You know, that's why you lie in, because you let him do all the work, right?
Lie in. Yeah. I'm lying in, mate.
Yeah.
It's all good. But yes... as ever, it's exciting times. You do get that. You get a, for me personally, I don't even get it for the Open. This is the event that I get by far the most excited about year in, year out. And the fact that we've got now two within 5 months is absolutely fantastic.
Yes. Hopefully some fans come along to the second one as well. Some patrons, rather.
It's funny. I haven't... In any of the tournaments so far, it really hasn't bothered me that the fans aren't there. I actually love getting to see the full golf course and the pros having to play the full golf course. They're not getting these like barriers of fans that are stopping their balls or trampling down the rough and so on. I think for Augusta, we'll miss the roars a bit on the weekend in particular. I feel like this would be the one where I'm like, damn, I wouldn't mind a few fans. And maybe that's combined with the fact that the fans don't seem to do those stupid shouts at Augusta, you know, those mashed potatoes and whatnot,
because
they know if they do, they're just going to get booted out and they're never coming back in again. And so with that, you get this really, I'm not saying sanitized and clean, but a very respectful fan interaction with the players, you know, cheers, applause. And it's like, oh, that's kind of nice. There's no weird shit. There's no weird crap going on coming out. That all said, I am very interested to see the entire course on display, or as much as they'll show us with the cameras, without the fans there, or patrons.
I'm going to end this with one question to both of you. Does Bryson DeChambeau win the 2020 Masters?
Well, oh. He might come second to Bubba. I think he'll come reasonably close, Steve. But yeah, ultimately, I'm not sure he's going to get quite close enough to Bubba Watson to actually win.
I think it'll be an absolute roller coaster for Bryson. I think he'll be in and out of contention. He'll blitz some stuff. He'll make a couple. He'll make a double or a few bogeys. I think he'll ultimately fall just short. But it'll be just wild entertainment. Because based on what some of the points you've seen online about how far he's driving it and where he can put it to on certain holes and what trouble he can avoid, like it's just gonna be head blowing. This could break the game, and it could be a landmark moment in golf and. It should have been the US Open, but I think it might be the Masters. This could be the one that breaks it. And if he does do a proper job on it, even if he finishes maybe second, but somebody has to play out of their skin to do it, this could be the thing that tips them into saying, guys, in April, you're playing an Augusta Masters ball, and that's it. Then again, there's probably a lot of politics that goes on between the Masters, the RNA, and the USGA, so... I think it's going to be a wild. I don't think Bryson wins, but he comes very close. The establishing the winner, though, that's going to have to come in through the next few days.
Next few days, exactly. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time, gentlemen. It's been an interesting conversation as ever that we have when we come to these major previews. So well worth doing. I thank you for your time.
Cheers.
Yep. Look forward to talking again on Tuesday when we've all made our decisions over the weekend.
Yeah, and hopefully we have a couple of runners and riders in the two tournaments that are ongoing at the moment. I will finish by saying, as I say at the top of the show, please, if you can spare the time, give us a 5-star review over the next few days before Tuesday. I will read them out on the Masters Tips podcast. Thank you for your time. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. And we'll see you again next week for the 2020 Masters. Goodbye.